Welcome to Rebel Tales. I'm your host, Dwayne Crowley. Today I'm going to cover an ambush that doesn't seem to be all that well known, but it is a tragic story that should be told. This is the story of the Upton Ambush. So to give you the history book overview first, on the 15th of February 1921, members of the 3rd West Cork Brigade attacked a train carrying British troops at Upton Station. 3 volunteers were killed in action, as well as 8 civilians, and 10 were wounded. Now, let's take more detailed accounts of those who were there. And I'll start by taking a section from Liam Deasy's book, Towards Ireland Free. And even though Liam himself wasn't there, he was a senior officer and he would have got a full detailed report. British armed forces took advantage of regular passenger train services extensively as a means of transport, and this was something that we could not tolerate. The refusal of railwaymen to operate trains on which armed military were to travel was part of the effort to deny British forces the use of ordinary civilian rail transport. But we felt that something else was needed. We considered that, where possible, ordinary passenger trains carrying military ought to be ambushed, and that the consequent risk to civilians had to be accepted. We had a very good precedent. On the 11th of February, a very successful ambush had been carried out by the Mill Street Battalion on the Mallow to Tralee train at Drishnabeg in the 2nd Cork Brigade without civilian casualties. A party of troops travelling on the train had been attacked and defeated with a loss of 1 enemy killed and several wounded. The attacking party had no casualties and had succeeded in capturing 15 rifles and several hundred rounds of ammunition. Cork No. 1 Brigade, through its intelligence officer, Flory O'Donoghue, was sometimes able to get advanced information on the movements of British troops. Where this concerned other areas, it was normal practice to pass that information to the brigade concerned, if there was a possibility that it could be utilised there. It happened that 2 or 3 days after the successful train ambush at Drishnabeg, the intelligence of the Cork 1st Brigade informed our headquarters that a small party of British troops, probably 12 to 15 in number, would leave Cork for Bantry on the 9:30 a.m. train on the 15th of February. An arrangement was made to send a coded message by telephone to Bandon on the morning of the 15th to confirm the departure of the troops and to give their number and their location in the train. The brigade commander, Charlie Hurley, considered that the risk to the civilians in the train, in the event of an ambush, would not be abnormal, and indeed that it would be limited by the fact that the carriages occupied by the troops would be known in advance. There appeared to be every reason why an ambush on this train should be as successful as that of Drishnabeg a few days before. So the ambush was decided upon, and the location chosen was Upton Station, 4 miles east of Bandon. As there was no time available in which to mobilise a battalion column for the operation, Charlie quickly collected a party of local volunteers, together with the acting brigade adjutant, Flor Begley, and the general staff officer, Sean Phelan, and with them finalised his plans. The passenger platform of Upton Station was on the north side of the railway line. On it were the usual buildings, station master's house, ticket booking office, waiting room and toilets. Extending west from the buildings as far as the signal cabin was a timber paling with a wicket exit. On the opposite side of the rail, a goods store occupied the eastern end of the station, and the goods bank to the west was bounded by a low wall to the south. At the southern extremity, there was a 2-story public house. Arriving at the station a few minutes before the train was due to arrive, Charlie Hurley quickly put the attacking party in position. Pat O'Sullivan and John Butler were stationed at the toilets, the former armed with 2 45 revolvers, the latter with a rifle. Flor Begley and Sean Phelan, both with Colt automatics, were in the waiting room. Paddy O'Leary took up position at the wicket gate and Sean Hartnett at the gable end of the signal cabin, both armed with rifles. Charlie himself took up a position on the footbridge that spanned the line at the western end of the platforms and was armed with a Peter the Painter. On the opposite side of the station, Bat Falvey and Neelius Begley were posted at the goods store, Dennis Desmond and Dan O'Mahony behind the low wall, and Paddy Coakley at a window upstairs in the public house. Finally, Tom Kelleher and Dennis Doolin held positions behind the wall at the entrance to the goods yard. These 7 men were armed with rifles. All was now in readiness. An attacking party of 14 men within the station and a party of local volunteers for scouting and protection duties posted outside in the neighbourhood of the station. The scene was set. Presently, the noise of the approaching train was heard. Unfortunately, there had been an unforeseen development. Between Cork and Upton, there was a railway junction known as Kinsale Junction, where British troops from Kinsale could join the Cork to Bantry train And this is precisely what occurred that morning. A party of close to 50 soldiers from Kinsale Barracks boarded a train at the junction and mixed among the civilian passengers. Seeing what was happening at the junction, a valiant effort was made to warn the ambush party by Bill Hartnett, a brother of Sean, who was waiting to attack the train. Realising the danger, he jumped on a bicycle and rode as fast as he could in hope of reaching the Upton train station before the train. Unfortunately, he arrived a minute or two too late. As the train pulled into the station, the attackers opened fire. This was immediately returned by the soldiers as they poured out onto the platform. When Charlie Hurley, from his vantage position on the bridge, saw what was happening and that the enemy force greatly outnumbered his own small group, he gave the order for withdrawal, shouting to those on the south side to fall back towards the level crossing and gatehouse to the west of the station. His own gun jammed after the first shot, and he jumped down from the bridge. He received a bullet wound in the face from ear to ear and also sprained his ankle. Among the six on the north side, casualties were heavy. Pat O'Sullivan was mortally wounded, and Sean Phelan was killed as he tried to escape through the waiting room window. Flor Begley, Paddy O'Leary, John Butler, and Sean Hartnett succeeded in getting clear under fire, though the latter was wounded. On the southern side, Bat Falvey was shot through the head and he died instantly. The others fell back to the level crossing, helped by the protecting fire of Tom Kelleher and Dennis Doolan. When Doolan joined his companions, he found that Dan O'Mahony had been wounded, and he carried him on his back for almost a mile to Tim Gronin's of Clashnamood. Later, Dan was taken to Ballinfellig and from there was conveyed by Willie Cotter to the South Infirmary, Cork. Although he recovered under treatment, he died a few years later as a result of his wounds. Tom Kelleher went to the assistance of Charlie Hurley, who was so seriously wounded and lamed that he had no chance of escaping on his own. However, Kelleher practically carried him from the scene and conducted him by a strategic route in the direction of Kilmore. Mile after mile, the pair struggled on, Hurley repeatedly begging his rescuer to leave him and to make his own escape. Kelleher, with indomitable courage and unflagging determination, insisted on bringing his wounded companion to safety. Eventually, in the late afternoon, the pair reached the comparative security of Patsy Sheehan's of Kilmore. Here, they rested while Charlie's face and ankle were bandaged. Then, they continued their journey to Tim O'Sullivan's of Cladough, where professional treatment was soon available. For several days, Charlie recuperated at Cladough, and during this time, he was ably nursed by Mrs. O'Sullivan. Security reasons demanded his transfer, first to Healy's of Farran, and then to Brigade Headquarters at Denny Ford's of Ballymurphy. Pat O'Sullivan, shot through the stomach and bleeding seriously, managed to escape from his position on the station platform and, under the protection of a deep trench, dragged himself out of the danger zone and continued for almost a mile to Tim Cronin's of Clashnamood. He was completely exhausted when he finally crawled into the house. Only a short time earlier, Doolan had arrived with his wounded companion, Dan O'Mahony, and as soon as Mrs. Crony put a temporary dressing on Dan's wound, the two set off again. The good woman now did what she could for Pat O'Sullivan, and then had her son Batty take him in a horse and a trap to Healy's of Farran before the military cordon had sealed off the area. On the following day, Jack Kennefic of the 1st Cork Brigade conveyed O'Sullivan to the North Infirmary. It was too late. O'Sullivan died shortly after his arrival there. The bodies of Sean Phelan and Bat Falvey were taken to Cork, but were later handed over to their relatives, and then, together with the remains of Pat O'Sullivan, were honourably buried in the Republican plot at St. Finbar's Cemetery, Cork. The fate of Sean Phelan was a particularly sad one. The only son of Liverpool Irish parents, he had come to Ireland a short time previously to offer his services in the national struggle, and the ambush at Upton was his first experience of being in action. In addition to the casualties among the volunteers, some soldiers were wounded. Unfortunately, there was a heavy toll among the civilian passengers. Six lost their lives and five others were wounded. This engagement at Upton was undoubtedly the most serious reverse suffered in the brigade, and what was particularly unfortunate about it was the loss it entailed of so many civilian lives, as well as the loss of three outstanding volunteers. Pat O'Sullivan had been a battalion engineer and he was not easily replaced. Bat Falvey had been active in many engagements throughout the battalion area, while Sean Phelan, a primary school teacher who qualified in England, was a most promising volunteer and showed remarkable aptitude for military administration. Finally, the wounding of the brigade commander proved, in its consequence, to be the major calamity of the engagement. There are some impressive stories of physicality there. When you think of cycling from the Kinsale Junction to Upton to warn the men, how fit that scout would have been, because the roads back then would have been tough terrain and those bikes wouldn't have been anything like the modern bikes. And the men who were shot to try and make it miles in injured condition, getting to safety, getting bandaged and then moving again. But there's one story of the incredible bravery of Tom Kelleher there, who helped Charlie Hurley across very, very hilly terrain to safety, who had just received a bullet through the face and a sprained ankle. That must have been incredibly, incredibly difficult. And if you heard last week's episode, you'll be familiar with the life of Charlie Hurley, who was the commanding officer here and was later to die in the morning of the Crossbarry ambush about a month later. Although the injury to his face was brutal, he really was recovering well by all accounts. And I want to add to this by reading the account of the ambush from Frank Neville's witness statement. Frank was the assistant brigade quartermaster at the time, and he wrote, "On February the 15th, the party, consisting of 10 local men armed with Ross Canadian and Lee Enfield rifles, and the remainder armed with revolvers and automatics, fell in at Raheen and proceeded to the station over 3 miles away. The country round is very flat, with very large fields sloping down to the station. Two scouts of bicycles were stationed at Kinsale Junction to report the number of military on the train to the men at Upton. Two other small parties were engaged in blocking the roads leading to the station. The train was due at Upton at 9:30 in the morning. Some of the ambush party took up positions in the station premises. A few others were in the goods store and behind a low wall close to the railway line. The scouts and the bicycle at Kinsale Junction failed to make it to Upton before the train. Instead of a small party of military in a couple of carriages, as expected, military from Cork City going on to the west were in all the carriages, the full length of the train. They were belonging to the King's Liverpool Regiment stationed at Skibbereen. As the train stopped, fire was opened by the volunteers, to which the military replied at once. Almost in the first volley, Sean Phelan, a Liverpool Irishman, and Bat Falvey were killed. Three others, Pat O'Sullivan, John Hartnett, and Dan O'Mahony, received terrible wounds. Shortly afterwards, the Brigade OC, who was on top of the iron footbridge over the railway, was wounded in the head. 6 civilians were killed, 4 passengers, and 2 railway officials, the guard and a porter. After a short while, the Brigade OC blew his whistle as a signal to retreat from what was a hopeless engagement. The wounded Brigadier and Tom Kelleher got 100 yards down the line under heavy fire as far as the level crossing. Kelleher got a position in the turnstile wicket and opened fire on the military who were advancing in all directions. Under that covering fire, the other members of the attacking party managed to extricate themselves. Dan O'Mahony, wounded in the hip, was helped along by Din Doolan to Murphy's farmhouse, a short distance away, where he collapsed. The Murphy family did all they could for him and hid him in the corner of a field where he remained all day and until nightfall. Enemy raiders failed to find him that night where he was concealed. He was removed that night by some civilians. During the day, he was attended to by Father O'Connor of the Order of Charity. This priest belonged to the Upton Industrial School and was a good friend of the IRA. O'Mahony, after spending a long time in the Cork Hospital, recovered but died some years afterwards from the effects of the wounds he had got. John Hartnett, who was shot through the lung, was helped away by O'Leary and a few others. He also recovered. Pat O'Sullivan, a man of a splendid physique, was shot through the stomach. Despite this, he made his way alone, carrying his rifle for a mile through the country to a farmhouse, where he got some attention and was then removed in a trap to the northern end of the company area. He got some medical attention but died a few days later in a Cork hospital. The Brigade OC and Tom Kelleher, after covering the retreat of the others, had to make their way at least a quarter of a mile through open country before they were out of a rifle range from the station. They eventually got away some miles into comparative safety, where the Brigade OC was able to get medical attention. He recovered from his wounds, but was killed on the morning of the Crossbarry ambush about 5 weeks later. The bodies of Falvey and Phelan were taken to Cork by the military, but were claimed as relatives by members of the city coming them on. They, along with Pat O'Sullivan, were buried in St. Finbar's Cemetery in the Republican plot. Some casualties were caused among the British, all wounded, but the numbers were never made known. On the day of Pat O'Sullivan's burial, while his family were in Cork, his home at Raheen was raided extensively by British military, a workman there being arrested and interned. A woman and a young girl who were in the house at the time were arrested too, and were taken around the country all day in a lorry. They were, however, brought back unharmed and were released at nightfall near Raheen. About this time, an enemy spy was arrested by members of the Knockavilla Company. He was badly wanted by the 1st Cork Brigade. He was handed over and was duly shot. Patrick O'Leary, the company OC, was arrested towards the end of February, but he was not identified and was released after a few weeks. Five other members of the company were arrested as well. Some of them were interned, and a few others, though they were badly wanted men, were released. So you can see there are a couple of slight differences there between the accounts mentioned in Liam's book and mentioned in Frank's witness statement. And that's what makes this era so interesting, that there were these little discrepancies of ordinary men and incredible situations. Frank there didn't mention the shooter from the window from the IRA side. And I think that's the railway bar, which is still standing today. When I was researching this, actually, there was another incredible story that stood out from Frank Neville's account. And I'd read that somewhere else. I think it was Guerrilla Days in Ireland. But I want to read it to give you an idea of how dangerous it was at the time for these men going about their daily lives. And this is another short excerpt from that his witness statement. One day, towards the end of the month, I was working, repairing a fence in a field, and I could hear a distance off a sound as if a tractor was engaged on winter ploughing. Tractors were not very common at this time, and I did not pay any great attention to the noise, unfortunately for myself, for the sound must have been that of a military lorry. At all events, shortly after, I was ordered to put my hands up, and three British officers appeared over the fence and held me up with their revolvers unpleasantly close to me. From the description I got afterwards, one was Major Percival of the Essex Regiment, and another was a Lieutenant Hotblack, the man who spoke with a pronounced stutter. I did not know who the other was. Percival asked me my name, and when I did not reply, he told me it himself, and also told me a lot more about myself, detailing activities in which I had taken part, and telling me that it was no use in denying such. I was marched away by these three officers and down and into Jago's farmyard, where I was held for a considerable time while parties of the Essex Regiment assembled there, apparently after raiding the locality. As each party came in, members of it made it their business to knock me about, and altogether I received pretty bad handling from them. Two other prisoners were brought in, one of whom I recognised as a volunteer. When all the military were assembled and ready to move off, Percival ordered the other two prisoners to be put in the first lorry, saying they are for Bandon. He ordered me to be put in the last lorry, saying he is going to Cork. I had other views in this matter, more specifically, when after the convoy moving off, the last lorry, of which I was one of the occupants, stopped every 100 yards or so, as if to increase the distance between it and the convoy in front. Eventually, when it was isolated, it halted at the end of a boreen, leading up to a narrow ravine with high hills on each side, and I was ordered to get out onto the road. One soldier only descended from the lorry. He was a corporal, and I distinctly remember he wore a cap instead of a tin helmet. He climbed down from the cab of the lorry, armed with only a short Webley. He ordered me to move and urged me up the boreen at the point of a revolver, until the two of us were out of sight of the lorry on the road. I knew what was intended, and that the excuse for what was about to be done would be shot while attempting to escape. At the critical moment, as if by instinct, I turned sharply, and he fired at the same moment. I could see a flame from the muzzle of the revolver almost touch my chest, and I made a spring. Though the road was a sheet of ice, I did not slip as I ran up along it before I cleared the boundary fence in one jump. As I ran up the road, I could hear several sharp reports from the gun of my deputed killer. I got across several fields with the one idea of saving my life, and about three fields away, when clearing a fence, I went over in my head and I could not rise. I thought I had been shot, and I could feel the dampness running down my chest. I felt with my hand for the blood, but it was the sweat from all of my efforts. Finding I was unhurt restored my strength, and I got up and I moved on, avoiding the lower ground for fear the locality would be encircled and that I would be caught in the ravine. I, however, escaped and did not know if any attempt was made to go after me. As far as I could see, when in Jago's farmyard, all the personnel of their Essex regiment seemed to be a low, evil crowd, and I formed the opinion that they were mostly drawn from the London underworld. You know, there are so many stories of volunteers being shot as they tried to escape throughout Irish history. And for the most part, it's believed that they were murdered. And this was just the language used by the British as the cause of death. Now, this was 5 days before the Clonmel ambush, which was another disaster for the Cork volunteers. And I covered that ambush back in episode 4. And in that episode, I read Dermot O'Leary's account of a group of black and tans coming into the hospital and beating a survivor of the Upton ambush to death in his hospital bed with the butts of their rifles. But I've found since research done by UCC that suggested that was actually Jim Barrett. And I just want to take a second to read this because it's a really disturbing account of what happened. But Jim Barrett was actually at the Gypsy ambush. And even though he was a station master by occupation, he hadn't been at Upton. And what they found here is very interesting, actually, and it's to add a bit more detail to that account, which I think is only fair. A station master by occupation, Barrett had been badly wounded in the abortive Gypsy ambush on the 28th of January 1921, and he died of his injuries, which were gunshot wounds to the left thigh followed by septicemia, at Cork Military Hospital in Victoria Barracks on the 22nd of March. In a vain effort to save his life, one of his legs had been amputated. He had served as an adjutant of the 6th Battalion of the Cork No. 1 Brigade. His funeral from the Catholic Cathedral in Cork to Dunamore on the 24th of March was subjected to the usual military harassment. There was a party of military present in two lorries, accompanied by an armoured car, and the officer in charge informed the relatives that not more than 30 or 40 persons would be allowed to walk after the remains. When the cortege started, the military cars took up positions next to the mourners' cars and accompanied the funeral to the journey of Dunamore. Despite his wounds, Jim Barrett had apparently received a severe beating while confined as a patient in Cork Military Hospital. Though the author of the following account, Volunteer Dermot O'Leary, one of the wounded Clonmult prisoners, misidentified Barrett with the Upton train ambush, there appears to be little doubt that the station master Barrett was the victim of the vengeful assault described by O'Leary. With me in the hospital ward were some of the other patients, one of whom I remember had been the station master at Upton, County Cork. This man had fought with the IRA in the Upton ambush on the 19th of February 1921 and had been wounded and taken prisoner. His bed was nearest the entrance door. One night, following an ambush in Cork City in which some soldiers were killed, a few military came into the room and proceeded to beat this man unmercifully with the butts of their revolvers. He died from the effects of the beating. It is unclear whether this beating contributed to Barrett's death 3 weeks later. So I just wanted to add a little bit more to that story that I told on the Clonmult episode. And even though that man wasn't that Upton and he died 3 weeks later, it doesn't take from the savagery to beat a man with the butts of the revolvers who had just had his leg amputated and was suffering from septicemia while lying in his hospital bed. But to go back to the Upton ambush, I want to name the civilians who died in that ambush too. And this information is sourced from the website The Cairo Gang, which of course was the nickname given to the British intelligence officers in Dublin. The Cairo Gang website is actually an incredible resource for research, especially on the British forces in Ireland during the War of Independence. There's some really, really impressive research done, and I'm not sure who actually conducted the research, but it's really, really helpful when looking into the times in Ireland. And there are some conflicting numbers of the deaths. Some accounts say 6 civilians, some say 8, but there are 10 names here. John Spears, Thomas Perrott, James Byrne, Charles Penrose Johnston, William Finn, May Hall, William Donoghue, Sean Hegarty, John Sisk, and Richard Arthur. And the three IRA men there mentioned also earlier were Lieutenant John Whelan, who was a native of Liverpool, Lieutenant Patrick O'Sullivan, and Section Commander Bat Falvey. War and any loss of life is sad, but it's always especially upsetting when civilians are killed in any kind of an engagement. I think that soldiers on both sides of war knew what they were risking when they signed up, but civilians and innocent bystanders that get caught up when they were going about their day-to-day lives have no say in their fate. The railway station is still there today in Upton, and it's on a quiet road on the back roads by Briney on the way to West Cork. And even though the railway is long gone, there is a shrine memorial there tucked in off the road, but it's not a very well-known site. Now, there's no sign of the horror that happened that day over that 15-minute period, but hopefully this podcast will help to keep the memory of those events going. And interestingly, this ambush happened during a period known as the 12 Dark Days, in which 11 members of the 3rd West Cork Brigade were killed. Some were killed in action like Upton, some were killed in an accident, but there were 4 volunteers who were executed at the side of the road by the Essex Regiment when they were digging a ditch, and all 4 of them were shot in the head execution style. And there are many more stories like that, but we'll get to those in future episodes. So thanks for listening today. Like I said in a previous podcast, I've no intention of setting up a Patreon or anything like that for the podcast. But if you are looking for a way to support it, please consider buying one of the books mentioned in any of the podcasts to support the tiring work being done by those incredible local historians who, in a lot of cases, self-publish their books. And some of these books are from the people of the Revolution who are long gone. But buying their biographies will encourage the publishing houses to keep them in print for future generations to pick up. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, please consider following it and leaving a rating on whatever platform you're listening to it on. And I post some resources over on the Instagram page, and you'll find that at Rebel Tales Podcast. So that's all from me today. I'll be back next week with the Cross Barry ambush story. In the meantime, thank you for listening to another episode of Rebel Tales.